Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 10th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Stinging Nettle Botanics, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Alexis Perlmutter from Perlmutter Dermatology, a physician-owned private practice in Delmar, New York. Dr. Perlmutter specializes in both pediatric and adult dermatology, as well as dermatologic surgery. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. If you have a skin question for Dr. Perlmutter, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Your skin and you coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In the studio this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Alexis Perlmutter, a dermatologist from Perlmutter Dermatology, a physician-owned private practice in Delmar dedicated to offering a full spectrum of dermatological services. This includes medical, surgical, and select cosmetic treatments tailored to individuals of every age. Dr. Perlmutter is dual board certified in dermatology and as a pediatrician. She earned an MD degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, completing a pediatrics residency at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a dermatology residency at Geisinger Medical Center, where she completed specialized training in pediatric dermatology. Number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter, welcome back. Beautiful day, huh?
Yeah, great, great day. Good to be here again, Ray. Thanks for having me.
How are things going at the private practice?
Oh, very good. We're very, very busy and loving our work. I have one other provider there with me, Dave Foster, and we have great time. Great
good.
Staff. We're doing well.
Now, I understand there's a prominent birthday in your life right now. You might as well do the shout out now.
Should I sing a song?
Well, it depends on how
different
good
show,
you are,
different
I guess.
Show.
You know.
I was always waiting for that moment to sing on the radio.
Really?
Dave Perlmutter's birthday today.
Hey.
He turns 40-something. I'm not going to tell everybody.
Well, you know what? He gets a present because he gets to be on this show coming up later
Perfect.
This month, right?
Yep. That's
the
right.
Number here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You know, I've heard talk from doctors about precancerous conditions of the skin. And I wonder, are there any non-cancerous conditions that can be real precursors to skin cancer?
Non-cancerous conditions?
Like, absolutely.
You're
talking about psoriasis
absolutely. So that's a great example right there. So psoriasis is a skin disorder that's not precancerous, I guess, in theory. But patients who have chronic psoriasis that's not treated well have a higher risk of having squamous cell skin cancers because they have...
Now, what is squamous cell?
Mm-hmm. That's a type of skin cancer, one of the most common that we see in the skin. Squamous cell skin cancers can be in any organ, actually. Well, many organs. I shouldn't say any organ. But they are made from one of the skin type cells in the skin called a squamous cell. And obviously genetically, when they go awry, they create a cancer. And the number one reason they form is sunlight. But some conditions.
So the UV rays?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. But some conditions like psoriasis, there's another condition called xeroderma pigmentosum. There's other genetic disorders where the shed rate is either too high, too slow, and then that creates a higher risk for a genetic error to happen.
Uh-huh.
When that genetic error happens in the squamous cell and that cell replicates, then you have a squamous cell carcinoma.
But if you're prone to skin tags, I remember my father had a lot of skin tags toward the end of his life. You're not necessarily prone to skin cancer. That's
Mm-mm.
a totally different bag.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Think of a skin tag as a little bit of like a redundancy of normal skin. It's not just normal skin. There's some other tissue in there, but they're completely harmless.
Okay, this email, we'll do a couple emails, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll go to the phones with Dr. Alexis Perlmutter, and my email's taking a few minutes to load. We're having some problems here, technically. Okay, here we go. Barb in Schenectady writes, I have the BRCA1 genetic mutation as well as breast cancer. Since skin cancer/melanoma is possible with the BRCA1, How thorough should annual or more often skin checks be performed? Just visual skin checks by a dermatologist, or are there more thorough options? And that's from Barb in Schenectady.
That's a good question. Right now, having that genetic predisposition to melanoma doesn't up the frequency rate of exams more than once a year. That's something that our genetic colleagues help us figure out. Right now, it's still set at yearly. But the actual exam, it's still just a visual exam by a doctor or a provider. There are some newer technologies being used in dermatology that arguably may be better for detecting skin cancer. One of them is something called confocal microscopy, which is something I'm not trained in yet. The data is not really there yet to show that using that device helps you find melanoma or other skin cancers sooner. I don't know the technology
well. Is it a microscope of
some
kind?
Yeah, it's a device you hold on the skin.
Oh, interesting.
There's another technology they use where you put a little sticker on a mole.
Really?
And pull it off and send it to a lab, and they can test for some genetic errors in that mole. You actually don't cut the skin. You just sticker it.
It's interesting.
Fascinating. But that also has not been validated yet. So until we have validation that these technologies or these, you know, alternate ways of examining a person actually put us at a better chance of finding a melanoma, okay. I'm not going to employ them.
This is from James. Because I have had a melanoma at stage 3, I now see a skin doctor every 6 months for a checkup. Last time, they froze off a couple of eruptions on my arm that seemed to be like dead skin. Now they're just scaly patches. Is that effective for treating some skin things?
Yes. What they probably did is freeze off something in the keratosis family. There's two keratoses. They're very common, both of them. Both are treated with that spray, which is liquid nitrogen. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very cold. It's like dry ice. One of them is an actinic keratosis, and that's a precancerous spot. And the other is called a seborrheic keratosis, and that is a exquisitely common little rough spot that grows all over lots of people.
Yeah.
Pretty much every human has those. Mm. And they're benign, but often they're sprayed off because people don't like them.
Oh.
So I don't know which one that individual had, but either way, they usually leave a little bit of like a scaly residue, either white colored or maybe sometimes darker pink colored. But that has nothing to do with melanoma, importantly. So at that visit, if you're getting seen for melanoma and they use a spray can, that liquid nitrogen, to spray something off, that is not related to your risk or of melanoma. It's not related to precancerous lesions in the melanoma family.
Interesting. You know, they spray the nitrogen now. When I was a kid, this is a long time ago, nearly 50 years ago probably, had a big wart on my finger, and I went to my primary care. And he had the nitrogen, I believe, in a thermos, and he had a swab and just put it on.
Yes.
But now they spray it.
Well, yeah. Once again, technology's improved, meaning just the device to deliver the liquid nitrogen. It's a little expensive, but most dermatologists have that.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, shoots it out like a tip, a nozzle.
Oh, cool.
But we do still sometimes do it that way if our patients are nervous.
Really?
We pour it in a little styrofoam cup and use a Q-tip and touch it. So maybe you were just nervous.
Well, I don't know. I didn't know what was going on. Let's take a break now. And you know what? That holds true today. I still don't know what's going on. It's Medical Monday. I know that. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter joins us. Dermatology. We'll be back. Yes. Love to hear some Sonny Rollins here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter joins us from Perlmutter Dermatology in Del Mar, New York. Are you ready to hit the phones?
Sure.
All right, let's do
this.
We'll go to Rotterdam. Robert, you're on.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Sure, go ahead.
All right. Okay. My question is, why don't dermatologists want to treat severe psoriasis?
Huh?
Why don't they want to treat it?
Well, I'm not going to give up the name.
Good.
Of the dermatologist on Gilliland Avenue.
All right, appreciate it.
Anyway,
all right, that's fine.
They told me that this is an autoimmune disease. I got to go see my autoimmune doctor. I don't get it.
Yeah. So the psoriasis is complex, but it's definitely a condition that most of the time a dermatologist wants to tackle. I would say we consider it like an not really autoimmune, but immune mediated, meaning there's so many different proteins and enzymes in the body that have to do with why we get psoriasis. And it's yeah. very true that when you have psoriasis, you're at risk for other immune conditions. So,
I actually have autoimmune disease. I got RA. All right. It all comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
My father had it bad, but I didn't get it until I was age 60.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand. And the only thing they give me is a salve. All right. Rub it on your skin. They
yeah.
want me to go to my rheumatologist, and I'm trying to work with them.
Yeah.
Oh, they want me to go on Skyrizi. How is that?
So I was just going to say, sometimes what happens is there's medications, and Skyrizi is one of them, that's indicated for two different conditions. And so it's like killing two birds with one stone. And Skyrizi is one of those.
Yeah.
It's a very good medicine that treats psoriasis, and it also treats rheumatoid arthritis. So that would make sense. One of the interesting things is that often when those medicines that treat skin and joint disease are used, they're used often at higher doses for the joints than they are for the skin. So, for example, it would make more sense for your rheumatologist to talk to you about if they would use that for your joint disease, the RA. Because most likely we dermatologists would end up giving you a lower dose for psoriasis. So it does make sense to start with a rheumatologist.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. That's what I've done. And she's seen it. And she goes, I don't have problems with my RA anymore.
Mm.
I was on Humira before, but Humira never treated it, psoriasis.
Okay.
Well, Skyrizi is a really good medication, one of the best, in fact, for psoriasis.
Interesting. All right, Robert, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter joins us. Now, there are a couple different kinds of arthritis, right? There's
mm-hmm.
rheumatoid and
psoriatic.
Psoriatic.
Mm-hmm.
This guy had psoriasis. Are there two different types of that, too?
No, it's interesting actually to have psoriasis and RA. It's possible. It's also possible to have psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis.
Uh-huh.
That's a little more common than having psoriasis and rheumatoid arthritis. But any of these scenarios is possible.
800-348-2551 is our number. It's Dermatology Today on this edition of Medical Monday with Dr. Alexis Perlmutter from Perlmutter Dermatology. And let's go to Maria in Saugerties. Maria, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for listening to me.
You bet.
I'm calling for my granddaughter. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm calling for my granddaughter. She's had a fat lip on one side for over 2 months. It got better. She thought maybe it was, herpes, but not. I mean, she does get cold sores once in a while, but this is not a cold sore. It's just a swollen lip on one side. It kind of went down and then it came back. And she's been doing some research on her own. She said she thought it was a MUCCOLE. Do you know what that is? And is there anything a dermatologist can do to help her? Because it's really bothersome.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you know how to say it, too? That's another thing.
It's a mucocele, yeah. So that's something we learn about. It's actually something inside the mouth. And mucoceles they're kind of neat when you see them. They're almost translucent, and they have a little bit of a bluish look to them. And if you pop them, uh-huh. it's like this kind of clear fluid comes out, almost sticky, because it's mucus.
Yeah.
But that shouldn't cause a swelling on the outside of her lip. So usually mucoceles are in the inside of the mouth along the wet mucous membrane. So that probably wouldn't cause that. I think it's definitely worthwhile for her to see a dermatologist because there's so many different things it could be. I will say with young people, things like canker sores, cold sores, which are two different things, they can both cause lip swelling. You have to make sure she doesn't mm-hmm. have a problem with her dentition there because if she had like a tooth abscess or a cavity, that also could cause it.
Mm-hmm.
And then things we see on the outside, actually on the skin, a lot on the lips of little people, are contact irritation from different products they're using. So You know, an example is, you know, if I don't mean to make this, this is an older popular brand, but there was a great amount of reaction when the EOS, EOS came out, like maybe 6 years ago. It was so popular. Everyone was getting contact reaction on their lips from it. And we saw it all the time. Yeah, it's just it was just a brand of like lip gloss type thing. Mm. But that's always possible. That's something that she's using, you know, has a has an ingredient in it that, that bothers her lip and creates a swelling. And then the other thing to think about, it doesn't always make sense sometimes why something that you put all over your lips might just swell the left lower corner. So even that, it's like, well, it has to be only something that touches my left lower lip. That the skin doesn't always follow those kinds of rules of logic.
I see. Okay. So, yeah, she does use a lot of lip product. She likes having soft, beautiful, supple lips.
Oh,
so she does use a lot of things. So, yeah. Okay. So, EOS, I'll have her check that. And thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Don't panic if you're seeing the screen, doctor. We're having a little delay issue on our phone screen. It just Maria apparently is still there, but she's gone.
No problem.
This email from Kevin, and I don't know if Kevin works for the dermatology industry, but Kevin in Greenfield writes, I've been working outside for 30 years, and every time a questionable thing pops up on my skin, I run to my dermatologist. Don't ignore anything. Peace of mind is worth the copay. How about that?
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, how about that one?
I paid him to call. Just kidding.
No. Let's go back to our phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Susan is in Poughkeepsie. Susan, you're on.
Hi. I have a question for the doctor. My beautiful 22-year-old daughter has really bad acne. She has PCOS, and she takes spironolactone, and she takes a birth control, but nothing is tackling this acne, and it just breaks my heart. And we've gone to dermatologists and the creams and potions and lotions, and nothing's working. Is it something she just has to age out of?
That's a good question, but I hope not. I mean, you mentioned a couple really, really good medications that we use for hormonal acne in young women who also have PCOS. We use it also in people, women who don't have PCOS, but that's oral birth control pills and then spironolactone. One piece of information that is interesting or relevant is how high her dose of spironolactone is. Sometimes people go even up to 200 milligrams a day to help with hormonal acne. But honestly, probably the biggest thing is having the gynecology team help to control the PCOS in any way that they can. Because, you know, as the name suggests, hormonal acne is mostly driven by not just abnormal levels of hormones. Maybe the levels are just fine. It's just the way those hormone levels are seen in the skin.
Uh-huh.
So really getting the PCOS under wraps would help. And then when all else fails, there's always Accutane or isotretinoin. Now, that's not my go-to for hormonal acne because honestly, it's usually a temporary fix. It's more often a permanent fix in other kinds of acne. But when it comes to hormonal acne, it usually sort of extinguishes the acne for as long as you're on the medicine. And it really is a cure in about 85 to 90% of people. But then, unfortunately, in people with hormonal acne, it tends to come back unless you've really gotten the hormonal piece under wraps. So I think, you know, not to kind of ignore that part of it. The PCOS is a big part of her acne, my guess is.
Susan.
So you're saying increasing the spironolactone because my older daughter had the same problem too, and she went on a lot of a higher dose of the spironolactone, and it certainly did help.
Mm-hmm.
But also she's, you know, 7 years older. I don't know, but they both are on the birth control, and they, you know, the doctor was, you know, reluctant to raise the, I know she has a different provider, to raise the spironolactone. And now the older daughter, they're weaning her off of it. Is it dangerous to be on that for too long, or I don't know?
It's not so dangerous. It's used at high doses for long periods of time for people to lower their blood pressure. It's a diuretic.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing to think about is what birth control is she on? So there's about four or five out there that are FDA approved for acne. They're the combined oral pills. So if it's estrogen and progesterone in there, that's good. if it's progesterone only that actually causes acne.
Ah.
So, and again, there's other medicines that do help control PCOS. That's not my field of medicine, but I guess what I'm saying is it really needs to be a conversation with someone who's willing to push the boundaries, maybe of the dose on the spironolactone. Also perhaps tinker with which oral birth control she's on. And then thinking about other medicines to control the PCOS, like a lot of doctors will use metformin to help control that.
Okay.
Thank you. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. Appreciate the call. It's 800-348-2551. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter joins us today. And we'll go to Albany. And Abby is on. Hello, Abby.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You bet.
So I just had a question regarding a spot above my eyebrow that's been there for, oh my gosh, I don't know, 20 plus years. It looks sort of like a freckle, and it's grown very, very slowly in size. And I would describe it mostly as stable. However, sometimes it is itchy, and even when I don't scratch that itch, it sometimes gets kind of scaly. And I was wondering if this is obviously over the phone, just listening to my description, you probably can't tell, you know, definitively what to do or what to advise me. But does this seem like something benign, or does it seem like it's worth going to a dermatologist to check out?
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 45.
Okay.
And I have probably, unlike a lot of people, I have avoided the sun almost at all costs. I usually, especially now, if I have to be out in the sun, don a hat in addition to wearing sunscreen. I wear sunscreen pretty much all the time. However, you know, I do have very, very fair skin. Mm. And, you know, I have been in the sun.
Okay.
Right. So it's of course, it's impossible to say, as you already said. But, you know, remember the thing I mentioned earlier? I don't know if you heard. I called it a seborrheic keratosis.
Actinic keratosis?
Yeah. So the seborrheic ones, those are the benign ones. They're called seborrheic keratosis. And they're often kind of flat, and they can get scaly sometimes. But go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is most oftentimes flat, save for the... I would describe it as rare. Every once in a while, it gets scaly. I would say a handful of times a year.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds pretty reassuring, the fact that it waxes and wanes back to being pretty flat. But it just because it's discolored and it seems like it's different than it was at the outset, it's probably a good idea just to get it looked at.
Okay. And then is it possible, and this is probably maybe not something you can answer, is it possible to see a dermatologist such as yourself without a referral, or do most dermatologists, regardless of what insurances require or don't require, want a referral regardless?
So that's all dictated by your actual insurance company.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Having a little bit of trouble with the computer here. Don't let it throw you off your game.
No problem.
All right. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter is our guest. Let's do a couple emails here, and then I'll try to figure out this computer. Dave writes in, 63-year-old male. I've been taking lisinopril for high blood pressure since August 24. Have since developed firm, colorless bumps on my face. While they're bothersome, they're not really irritated unless I pinch them. They're not particularly inflamed. An internet search seems to indicate nodular ache, a side effect of the medication, perhaps. I'm not sure what to do because I don't really want to take more medication. And that's from Dave.
Oh, man. I think that's the first stump of the day. I don't know what nodular ache is. But I think I'm just going to go off of the most important facts, your age, the fact that you started the medicine about a year ago, maybe 13 months or so, and then the fact that you said bumps on your face. It doesn't sound like classic acne. It could be a drug reaction, although it's pretty uncommon for the lisinopril. It would be uncommon for the lisinopril to cause a problem this many months out. So it could be unrelated. I think it's probably important just to get it checked out. I don't know.
Okay. And thank you for that email, Dave. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. The phone number is 800-348-2551. What say we travel down to Pennsylvania? And Jim is in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
I was wondering about a scab-like lesion may last for years, possibly start as a foreign body wood shaving type thing or splinter.
Okay. So really that shouldn't last for years. There's a couple things that are benign, that one in particular I'll talk about, that is a persistent scab-like lesion. And that's usually because the human finger, the human body is antagonizing this spot. So
Yeah. It's
called a prurigo nodule, and anything can trigger it. Bug bite, ingrown hair, foreign body, like you said, a splinter that worked its way out. And what happens, and you know, this is where it's really neat, dermatology meets psychology, you just can't really leave it alone. So you find it when you're watching TV, you sort of go back to that spot, you check on it, you maybe rub it a little bit. And actually then it gives the lesion new life. So it actually has a different look under the microscope when it's now a prurigo lesion, which is after scratching it or touching it for chronically for months, or even if it's intermittently, that spot, if you cut that off and look at the microscope, it no longer looks like a bug bite or whatever it was originally, an ingrown hair, a splinter. It now has the characteristics of what we call a prurigo lesion, which is essentially a very focused spot of callus. So my hunch is that if that thing hasn't progressed to, you know, an eruptive form of like a skin cancer, which would be different than just a little bump, my guess is somehow it's persisted because it's a prurigo nodule or a little prurigo lesion, which is you've been finding over the, months or years.
Jim, thanks a lot for that one. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter joins us today. Dermatology on Medical Monday. Back with more of your calls and emails in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by our friend Dr. Alexis Perlmutter from Perlmutter Dermatology today. And we'll go to a couple of emails and then back to the phones. This is from Jeffrey. Oh, boy, I tell you, it's slow going on my phone today. It won't load. All right, we'll go to the phones first, and I'll come back to this. Let's go to Albany, and it's Adam. Adam, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have rosacea, and I've heard that even though rosacea is less common among men, when they do get it, the symptoms tend to be more severe. Like, for example, they're at a higher risk of developing things like rhinophyma. And I just wanted to ask why you think that is. Does it have something to do with hormones? Because I know they say androgens can affect the oil glands, and men have higher levels of androgens. So could that play a role? Or I just wanted to ask about that.
I don't know if that's the case. You're absolutely right that that's one of the rhinophyma, just for everyone else's context, is when the nose gets a little bit bulbous. And I'm totally forgetting the famous comedian who had a bulbous nose.
W.C. Fields.
Yes, that's it. Exactly. So that's sort of an end stage of a type of rosacea. Not everyone will get that, even if you have chronic rosacea. But it is a little more common in men, it's true. Now, that being said, though, most people with rosacea don't progress to rhinophyma. And the most important thing is actually controlling the rosacea before you get anywhere near that. So using anti-inflammatories on the skin of your face, which is usually just creams. If you need to go to pills, you can go to pills long before you get to that. Because once you get to rhinophyma, you can't actually reverse that. There are some pretty intense therapies they do where they numb up the entire nose and they pare it down. They like Dremel it down. Yeah. So there are treatments for rhinophyma, but it's way better to attack the rosacea early with really easy to use creams, something like a metronidazole, which is a very, very commonly used cream, which is anti-inflammatory. So you never, ever get to that stage. I don't really know if the question has, if the reason it progresses has to do with hormones. I imagine that's probably a good guess, though.
Adam, thank you very much for the call. Jeffrey in Holyoke writes, I had a skin tag a few years ago, went to my doctor to address it. It was the first time I'd had one. I didn't have a sense of how serious it was. He offered to spray something on it to cause it to fall off, and it was very simple. A few weeks later, I got my bill and found my insurance classified this very simple spray as surgery. I write this partly to question if your guest recommends the sprays you can find in stores, and partly I write it to help educate listeners that it is, if it is recommended, they try to do themselves, they should try doing it themselves to avoid a surprise medical bill. Well, that's a fine thing to say to a dermatologist. But, I mean, insurance is what it is, right?
Yeah, so the treatment that you got was what we talked about earlier with brain warts is called cryotherapy or cryosurgery. It's actually called cryosurgery, which I often make this joke in the room. It makes us sound really, really awesome and intense for just spraying a little spray at you, you know. But yeah, that's considered cryosurgery. But one of the reasons it's characterized as cryosurgery is because it really is trying to make a point of it is a very serious treatment such that, you know, it's not available over the counter. Liquid nitrogen is negative 196 degrees Fahrenheit. Sorry, Celsius, which is
very cold.
Negative 300 plus Fahrenheit. So it's very, very cold. It's very, very dangerous if you don't use it correctly. So all that being said, I don't know what the insurance company, you know, reimburses for cryosurgery or what your doctor charged for cryosurgery. But if you buy the over-the-counter weaker versions, less cold versions of cryotherapy or liquid nitrogen, they don't work quite as well. And my personal opinion about treating skin tags is that when they are small with a very tiny base, I think cryosurgery is great. When they're a larger tag or where the part that touches your skin, so they can be pretty lobulated or like a taggy-like bump.
Yeah.
But if they connect to your skin with a very tiny pedicle, they can be sprayed off. If they connect the skin with a wide pedicle, 6 millimeters is a pencil eraser. So if you think about a 6 millimeter wide attachment, that spray is not going to be very effective. So in those cases, I numb up all those skin tags and snip them off because I think that's more effective.
Okay, and we've talked about this before, right? I mean, there are ways you can get rid of these skin tags that aren't freezing them off. And I think they even sell those in the stores,
yes,
too.
Yes. Basically, anything that's trying to get rid of a skin tag is an irritant. So it's like some people will use salicylic acid to get them off. Again, that's just an irritant. It's I think we've talked in the past about witch hazel. People have used witch hazel, an irritant, trying to irritate the skin so that it sort of dies, I guess is the best way of saying it. Other people tie it off with dental floss. I mean, yeah, you can do that stuff.
Have you ever done that?
No.
No, not in the office?
No. That's why I have all my fancy tools,
get some
Ray.
Rubber bands over at Office Max and save the overhead. Ah, nice. All right, let's go back to the phones. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter is our guest today. Robert's in Coxsackie. Robert, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I'm calling because about 2 months ago I got some jumping spider bites, which are like mosquito bites, except the itch lasts for like 2 weeks. And in the past, they've always healed, but I have three in particular that didn't and became large. They're larger than silver dollars now. Let me see. About 2 weeks ago, I was given mupirocin and clobetasol as topical ointments, and they're kind of working. They allow the wounds not to itch so much, but I was wondering if there's anything more aggressive that I can be using on it. Another thing I need to point out is that I'm also on Keytruda.
Okay. Sounds like the person that saw you didn't think they were infected so much so that you needed an oral antibiotic. They sounds like they covered their bases with an antibacterial, that's the mupirocin, and then an anti-inflammatory, which is the clobetasol. So that helps with like bite reactions.
Right.
It's not hot or tender. It's more itchy, it sounds like.
It's warm, but it's, unless I put something on it, it'll start to itch. Mm-hmm.
So you probably,
like
yeah. You probably have like a bite reaction, which they can be called bite granulomas. It's basically when you get a bite and the body's just not happy about it. And honestly, the Keytruda might be related because it sounds like, you know, three of the spots are just not reacting the way your body normally would have reacted to that foreign. The bite is really just the foreign antigen of a spider. But I don't think it's anything to worry about. Clobetasol is basically our best anti-itch, and I like what the provider did because they're covering their bases, keeping you from getting an infection. And then meanwhile,
they also took a swab and said there was no bacteria per se involved in it. So.
Great. Right, that rules out that you have a cellulitis, which can happen anytime the skin is broken. So, yeah, I think you just keep up what you're doing.
2 weeks on, 1 week off, 2 weeks on, 1 week off. That's what I have to do.
Yeah, I think icing is also really often an overlooked but easy treatment to just help things chill out, right? Not be as itchy, not be as red and irritated.
Right.
Yeah, I would do that for just maybe another month and just go back to the provider if it's not getting better.
All right, Robert, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday today. It's Monday, obviously. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter joins us from Perlmutter Dermatology in Del Mar, New York. And a lot of calls today. Let's see. Computer is a little bit slow, but I think I can see who's calling. Let's go to Teresa in Pittsfield. Teresa, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Doctor, I've had a lot of experience with sun damage and getting treated for it. The more significant areas required surgery, but I think I have a great dermatologist and plastic surgeon. A lot of the areas I have to routinely go for blue light. And I just wanted to know, do you think that is still effective?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I do. I like blue light therapy. It's something I've worked with. I don't yet have it, and I'm not sure I'm going to get it at my office. And I'll tell you why in a moment. But until until last year, when I started my own practice, I had only been at doctor's offices, dermatology offices, including my residency, and then two other offices I worked at, where we had blue light. And I use it all the time. It's a great therapy. You coat the skin ahead of time with a light sensitizer, and then after about an hour, hour and a half, depending on the office, you expose the patient, in this case your skin, to a blue light, and the light sensitizer helps expose sun damaged, genetically damaged skin cells so that they get killed by the light. And the only reason I don't use it as much anymore, and I chose not to buy it for my practice, is because there's two new creams out that work almost as well and arguably better. And what we're trying, what the blue light therapy and what these creams are trying to achieve is helping patients like you who've had a lot of trouble with skin cancer or, you know, you said spots that had to get cut off. So I assume those are skin cancers. Help to treat a whole field of skin versus a single spot. So we call this field therapy. And that's the nice thing about blue light. You kind of paint the whole area you want to treat. Mm. And after the light goes on it, if you don't have any damage, not much will happen. And if you do have damage, it all kind of gets killed or, you know, treated. I guess that's the way. So, yes, I think it worked. It's FDA approved. It's a great therapy.
All right, Teresa, thanks for the call. Now, the skin sensitizer, is that an ointment or something
mm-hmm.
that you put on?
Yeah, it's a topical.
And then?
It's levulinic acid.
Mm-hmm. Now, given the prevalence of things that emit blue light, computer screens, TV screens, anything else, can you get this sensitizer over the counter and just sit by your TV?
Right. You're a visionary. No. But what they do in Europe is called, like open light blue light. So, yeah, they paint the patients. You can't buy the medicine. You have to go to a doctor to get it. And then they instruct their patients to walk around for 3 days.
And look like a blue freak.
Yeah,
I'm in Blue
great.
Man Group. Okay.
Yeah, pretty
All
cool.
Right, let's go to Pittsfield. Angelica, you're on. Hello?
Hello.
You're on.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I just had a question, and I'm not sure if you can help, and I would love to get some answers, but the last, year and a half, I had a little nodule on my tongue, and it was small at first. I thought it was just a canker sore, and it kind of grew over the last year. I was on antibiotics for three different bites, like insects, dog, and other things. And so I'm not sure what it is. I know that I've heard that if you have parasites in your body, sometimes lumps and nodules will form, but I've never had anything in my mouth show up like that. So I'm just wondering what it could possibly be.
I don't know. It's funny. If it doesn't seem like an infection, which I can't imagine it could last all this time as an infection, then we're talking about a growth, right? Not so much an infection, but a growth. And there could be so many things. Actually, you can get a skin cancer on your tongue. Not to say it's that. I don't know. There's these things called bite fibromas where you mentioned having like a cold sore or canker sore. If you kind of refine that spot now and then and by accidentally bite it, you can create a lump, kind of like what we talked about earlier with the prurigo nodule on the tongue or on the corner of the cheek, just from kind of refining it with your teeth by accident. It could be as harmless as that. And of course, the therapy there is don't bite it. You know, it's really hard not to, the things in your mouth.
Right.
But I think that's worthwhile to go see either an oral surgeon or a dermatologist to have a look at that. Just because you don't, you know, by hearing the story, I don't know if it could be dangerous.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was associated with having, you know, a lot of antibiotics over like a very short time last year. You know, within 6 months, I was on antibiotics 3 times. So I wasn't sure if it was my body's response to that.
I don't think so, though. Yeah, I can't imagine how that would be linked, honestly.
All right. Well, good luck. I mean, most dentists will take a look at your tongue when you're having a cleaning, right? Let's go to Gilderland and Dennis. You're on with Dr. Alexis Perlmutter.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
A question, Doc, about skin cellulitis. The last 2 months I've been dealing with my left ear and now my right ear with what's been diagnosed as skin cellulitis. Been treated with a couple of rounds of antibiotics. And I'm just wondering if you could expound a little bit on what cellulitis is. There was no break in the skin or cut or anything. So how, could bacteria, like internal bacteria, was the cause of the infection? And is this something I have to be concerned about reoccurring in the future?
So that's a good question. It's hard to know how you, I agree with you 100%. It's hard to know how you got that without any breaks in the skin. I will say that.
Neither did the doctor at urgent care.
Around the ears, just common things being common. Around the ears, behind the ears, it's very common to get a little dandruff or eczema. And, you know, one thing that could have happened, you could have, you know, without thinking in your sleep, you kind of scratch it because it's itchy and flaky. And then that can be a mild break in the skin. But yeah, by definition, skin cellulitis, you really need the organism, the germ, to enter from the outside. That doesn't enter from the inside, meaning from the inside of your body.
And it's odd because I had the left ear infection in early September, and the right ear didn't start bothering me until early October.
Yeah, that is odd. That especially that you said that made me think, is there something else, like a predisposing rash, like something like an eczema or a dandruff, which loves to pick on the ears? That's sort of one. We think of dandruff as the head, the scalp, but it really does like to pick on the skin around the ears.
Huh.
And often people will, you know, not really realize they just little scratch behind their ear a little bit and they get an infection or they, you know, put their finger in their ear and kind of scratch at whatever it is, mild little itch, and they create a little cut and then therefore it can get secondarily infected. So, yeah, I agree. That's odd. So I would wonder if it's two primary skin infections that have nothing to do with one another. I think that's also pretty unlikely.
Yeah,
so I wonder if there's a unifying thing going on. Yeah.
All right, Dennis, thanks a lot. We'll have to leave it there. Very quickly, email from Garrett. I have multiple skin tags that seem to love to grow around my eyes. I have a large one on my actual upper eyelid. I've never done much about them. They don't bother me, and I'm no supermodel. So, hey, let them be. But if I wanted to treat them, could they all be done at one time? And why do they only grow around my eyes? And that's from Garrett.
Garrett, that is a very good question. People don't like when the tags grow around their eyes. I don't know why they grow there. They like places where the skin rubs. So armpits and the neck fold are common areas. But the eyelids, I know it doesn't make sense. Our eyes, you know, the skin on the upper lid doesn't rub in the lower lid. So I don't have a good answer for that. But yes, usually if you just have a few, a dermatologist would be willing to cut them all off at once.
So, I mean, they don't have any detrimental health effect except that you don't want to have people staring at you and say,
correct.
God, look at all the skin cosmetic. Tag on your eyelid, Garrett. I hear you, man. Hey, thanks for the email, and thanks to everybody who wrote or called in today. Dr. Alexis Perlmutter of Perlmutter Dermatology. It's wonderful to have you here with us today. We'll see the birthday boy in a couple weeks, I guess,
right? That's right.
Well, I hope you guys have a great holiday season, and we'll talk to you next year. Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live at age gracefully with dignity and respect. DaughtersofSarah.org. Thanks again to Alex Perlmutter of Perlmutter Dermatology for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Sorry if we didn't get to your question today. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Wonderful job, sir. Bob Rathbun screened the calls. Bob, not your fault. The computer's been a bit wonky. Maybe you had something to do with it. Maybe you didn't. I'm not going to blame you at this time. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, no Vox Pop. I'm taking the day off. We'll be back on Wednesday for Pets und Vets. We'll see you at 2 p.m. Wednesday.